Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is July 6th, 2004. Today's speaker is Peter Thompson. The lesson for today is Red, White, and Blue. Can patriotism come in different colors? Let's listen in.
Showing to be wrong again. So thanks for coming. My name is Peter Thompson. I'm a carpenter right here in the village for 3 weeks. When I come up, I'm hardly ever on teaching staff anymore, but I did a lot of forums when I lived here long term a couple years ago. So I kept doing that sort of thing now. I'm now back in the Twin Cities. I was a human rights and criminal defense lawyer for 35 years, and after a year here, I saw the light and went back and retired. But as soon as I got home, I was too antsy to just stay home, so I started going to United Theological Seminary back in the Twin Cities, and I've got a couple years left there. So, this is kind of a continuing conversation from a wonderful conversation we had a week ago on the war on terrorism, but with a different look. But I mined some of those resources, and some of the great comments at that forum came from a couple of the people who are presenters today. And so I want to introduce them to you. Before I do that, I just want to set up what I think are some healthy ground rules. Yeah?
I'm sorry. I'm just...
She was waving a flag, making her patriotic. By the way, while I'm doing the ground rules, you just might want to look. I thought it would be helpful, so I grabbed Webster's and I wrote up the definition of a patriot according to Daniel. He is a person who loves, supports, and defends his country. That was in the original, rather than his, her, and its interest with devotion. However, it's probably better, because when I think of most of the patriots that are branded patriots in the past, I think mostly of men, so maybe that's true. But what I try and encourage, at least when I facilitate a forum here, is the idea, I think, at Holden is to have a family conversation, kind of like the kind of thing you would have around the fireplace, and so it's apt we're here. And by that, have it be very sincere from the heart and also very respectful. And forums are always the best if people really speak about what they really do believe and feel. And here, also from a faith perspective, I think it's really incumbent on us to respect each other's opinions, because it's not an easy job to come up here in front of others and say what you think, or from back there. And so really to engender a really open dialogue and debate, it's more than, you know, winning or losing. It's really, you know, hearing different sides to any issue. And this is a real interesting issue. I mean, from my viewpoint, I know if you're looking at it from a dualistic standpoint, some people think that, well, like John Ashcroft said, it was right after 9/11, there were some people who were speaking out about the erosion of our civil liberties and things like that. And he said, you know, anyone who does that is not a patriot and is supporting the enemy. That's kind of one extreme. And the other extreme is people that look and they think of patriot only as nationalism, and that's really the root of all sorts of the wars and racism and ethnic cleansing and those sorts of things that have been going on in all sorts of theaters for, you know, a lot of the last century. So what I would like to do is encourage here a place where we fully dialogue, we don't really hold back any of our feelings, but we don't point fingers. And so we really learn to listen to each other. And so for that, what I'd like to do is have each of the four give a little statement. I've asked them each to talk 4 or 5 minutes. Then I will gently question each one a little bit to bring out a little more if I think that it would be helpful for people to understand what their point is, or points. And then we'll open it up. And open it up for similar statements you'd like to make or questions you may want to ask. And I'll do that through me so it doesn't ever get to be, you know, cross-questioning or, you know, Aaron thinking that, you know, Ben is wrong and get going this way. So I'd like to be the focal point for some of the things. And if they really don't want to answer one of the questions, you know, I'll ask if one of you would like to, or I can take a try at it, something like that. So with that, I will introduce the four. And Rolf and John are the two I got to know a week ago by their input. So I solicited their participation here. John is working in the kitchen. He says that on the epithet on his gravestone is going to be bull elk at the edge of the herd. So that probably tells you something about him. He was an army captain. He was a hippie with an earring. He's been a big brother, a Christian camp director. He has been a house husband, a father of a lesbian daughter. He's been retired for 5 years. He's been a crisis line volunteer for domestic violence and suicide prevention. And he's presently a student of culinary arts. And so we're fortunate to have him here with us in the kitchen. And you've got to just get the volumes up a little more, like we ran out of spaghetti last night. Well, the quality's been good, but we need more.
You folks be eating, man, I'll tell you. I'm sucking it down. That's good.
This is Rolf Aising.
You're not Norwegian, apparently.
No, I'm
Aising.
Aising. Aising, he's a retired pastor. Most of his ministry, he was an editor at Augsburg Publishing. He spent 8 years as a teacher in South Africa, and he has written several books in his spare time. And I think you'll be able to sense that when you hear him speak. Joan Lundquist next to me is a mother of three children. She is organist and choir director at Emmanuel Lutheran in downtown Seattle. And she's written a wonderful thing here, which I could have read when I was trying to say what I think forum should be about, and it would have been much quicker and much more to the point. Joan's favorite thing about Holden is interacting with all the amazing people who gather here and who form a new community every day. And Diane McCollum's from Edmonds, Washington. She's a retired elementary orchestra teacher. And Diane taught Joan's girls. Right here. But I didn't know that when the two of you got on the forum together, right?
Right.
She's been coming here to Holden for 9 years. And both of her parents came from Sweden. So she's first generation American. We didn't talk about order. Is there anyone who'd like to start or go last or whatever? Okay, John, you want to start?
Thinking about this, I wrote kind of my definition of what patriotism can be at its best and its worst. I have to read this to you. Patriotism at its worst form is a society where the individual freedom of choice with regards to ethical and moral concerns is given over to the psychology of the masses or the state. Patriotism in its best form is a willingness to sacrifice oneself for the good of the order or another person. And my heroes are St. Francis, who was a warrior first, a pacifist second, St. Ignatius, the person who started the Jesuit order, and David Ben-Gurion.
Oh, you done? Ben-Gurion, was he a soldier too? Okay. And then a statesman. There's one other person who followed that same thing that I can think about, man, is Leo Tolstoy.
Oh, sure.
Was, in addition, a philosopher and a writer. So among those parameters, how does that make you feel like tangibly on July 4th in the midst of a war.
Feel tangibly, and I'm not quite sure.
Well, both of those, the extremes, the very best and the very worst. We can kind of see some of both of those things.
I'm very much alarmed and in fear that, quote, patriotism at its worst is alive and ripe in the United States, much the same as it was in Germany. The yellow flags on Ford cars and the GMC cars in the East when I visited years ago made me sick to my stomach.
Is it possible to project a little?
Oh, certainly. I'm sorry. I was talking to Peter. I'm sorry. The patriotism at its worst is currently something that may be rearing its head here in the United States. Folks that are called to mass psychology and put yellow ribbons on their radio antennas to signify their patriotism without understanding the realities of battle and the realities of what war is about. Is a scary thing to me. The discussion a week ago had to do with our Army and how it's functioned, and I came to the idea that the difficulty that's going on now is we have a professional, i.e. a mercenary Army, people that are hired to serve and to kill for us. They're Americans, they're not Hessians or something like that, but what that does, it precludes the kind of citizen soldier, the person that chose to serve during the Vietnam era conflict, that maybe mediated or was able to modify some of the drive that someone who sees himself as a professional soldier in a certain situation, i.e. the prison at Abu Ghraib. If I've wondered why people are not out in the streets now as they were during the Vietnam conflict, and the simple conclusion I came to is because you all don't have folks at risk. If you all had folks at risk, you'd be out in the streets.
Were you drafted or enlisted to Vietnam?
I was an optometrist. I went right to optometry school out of high school, was through in 5 years and got a direct commission as a captain. If I had not chosen to enlist, I probably would have been drafted, but I chose to enlist. There were optometrists on the ground in Vietnam that were dropped into battle zones as I was not one. I served in Panama for 2 years, but there were many optometrists that served on the ground in Vietnam. So,
was patriotism part of the reason you enlisted?
Patriotism in the second sense that I described it, yes. My father had been a Baltic gunner in a B-17 in World War II, and that gave me my gestalt. I've always seen myself as a person who would step between someone that's being harmed and the harmee, the harmor, and put my own self physically at risk, and I've done that a few times on buses and various places. My calling right now is a calling in domestic violence and abuse, and I deal with that every day at the crisis line and the crisis clinic in Seattle. The terrorism you're all afraid of outside with the Muslim terrorists and all is percentage-wise very, very unlikely. The real terror in our society is just in your next door neighbor, generally a white man.
Thank you. Who would like to go next?
I'll go. I have a very, when I was reflecting on this, what I was going to say today, I looked at it from just my own personal, what does it mean to me to be a patriot? And I think there are two parts of it. And the first part for me is remembering, you know, remembering what we have, the gifts that we have, especially, you know, I'd love to be a patriot of a country where we can come to Holden Village and have chainsaws and the marching band.
Yeah.
After September 11th, I live in Seattle, my family and I went to a place in Seattle called the Seattle Center. It was where the 1962 World's Fair was held, the grounds, and in the part of those grounds there's a big fountain. And people in Seattle gathered there and brought flowers and shoes of people that were lost and pictures and letters. And I guess I never really thought much about being patriotic at all until I saw that. I thought, you know, I'm pretty proud to be part of a country where people come together to honor and respect people that were lost. And so, just this remembering of what we have, being grateful, but also recognizing that we do have a lot of flaws. I think there are a lot of ways that we, in this country, I'm not speaking of you folks here in this room, but the leaders are forcing things onto other countries. And I think we have a lot of gifts to offer, but I would like to see more graciousness on the part of our leaders and how we deal with the world as being part of the world. And to me, that's what we're looking for.
Do you think that right after 9/11 time, many people have spoken of that, what a special time it was in the horribleness, but then how not only as a country, but people around the world all rallied, you know, in favor of what, you know, the solidarity of the United States and the firemen going there, you know, to the scene and everything. Why do you think, or do you think, that has changed from 2001 to 2.5 years later?
My husband read an article in the paper about diplomats from around the world who, these are diplomats from many different administrations, Republican and Democrats, who have said and written a letter saying, all the work we've done for decades to build relationships, you know, it's all about relationships, all, you know, how we get along with one another in the world. And those relationships have been severed because of the forcefulness of our actions. And just saying, you know, we're going to do what we want to do, whatever. Who cares what the ramifications of it are? Mm. And so that really makes me sad, because that whole opportunity that we had of being part of this global community, you know, where people could work together and work for good, has been squandered. And it really makes me sad.
Thanks.
Joe?
When he first asked me to be on this panel about patriotism, I was thinking about patriotism to me. And my parents, as I said in my little description myself, my parents were both born in Sweden and were very proud to be Americans and thrilled to be in this country, and stressed it a great deal to my sisters and me that this was the best place on earth to be. Not that they didn't love Sweden, but they thought that America had so many possibilities. And I've always been very proud to be an American, and I still am. And although I agree, you said it exactly the way I felt, that the feelings of at 9/11 and afterwards have disintegrated as our country has acted in a way, our government, in a way that disappointed me, to say the least, I still feel almost like the feelings of a parent when you really love your child and unconditionally you're going to love that child no matter what, and that child has done something that's really upset me right now, but I still love that child, and I still love my country, and I still hope, I haven't given up, I still hope that we're going to be able to find something that we can turn ourselves around and go forward. Because my love for my country is still there.
What have you thought about what that something could be? For maybe rather than for all of us, you know, for yourself, you know, a spark is something to look at.
For myself personally?
Yeah.
To speak when I can about my feelings and about where I think things should go, and to try to, as we all try to do, to try to be Christ in the world, to reach out and help people, because even though I can't go out and end the war and solve the problems, I can help one person, and in continuing to do this, hope that it will spread.
I think she hit the nail on the head when she said to be Christ in the world, because as I looked at this day when I wrote it down, that was the word that really jumped out at me. I mean, what are we devoted to, or how many things can we worship? How many, and when there is a split in what we are worshiping, where do we find our center?
Somebody said the other day in one of the forums that look at your checkbook and you can see where you're devoted.
Thanks, Ralph.
My life has been focused on the Bible. And so I looked at the Bible when I came to prepare for this. I've never done any study on patriotism in the Bible, probably because it didn't seem to me that it dealt with the subject. Is there any patriotism indicated in the Bible? Well, it's hard to say. Certainly the nation of Israel promotes a type of patriotism, which I'm not sure is altogether in harmony with what the Bible might have been saying. The closest the Bible comes is between Nehemiah and Ezra. I think there is some patriotism shown there. They are dedicated to rebuilding the temple in Jerusalem. This was a very emotional thing for them, and I think that's probably as close as the Bible comes in illustrating some patriotism. But it is interesting to see they do not talk about the land of Israel, in spite of the promise that we all know about. They were interested in the temple in Jerusalem only. That was their entire thing. We're going to build the temple and put the walls of Jerusalem there again. And that is sort of the emphasis that I discover in people's emotional attachment to their land there. Not so much the land, but the temple, where God is. So even Jesus laments Jerusalem. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. Agony, because they are not responding as they should. And this is the call, it seems to me, in the exiles in Babylon. How could we sing a song when we're not at Jerusalem? They looked forward to coming back to Jerusalem, not necessarily to the land. And the prophets, I think they were patriots. The government didn't think so. They put Jeremiah in prison, as you probably are aware. But those prophets loved their country. But it was Zion, the place where God is, that attracts them. And yet, their patriotism is not limited. Jesus, in his first sermon at home, got into trouble because he gave the example of a Syrian, Naaman. And you recall that the townspeople rose up in anger because he picked a heretic, an infidel, a Gentile, as an example. What kind of patriotism are you showing, Jesus? They didn't put it in those terms, but there was an aspect of patriotism in that. And the prophets, with sadness, I think, and with anger, they tell about the evils that their country is doing. So it seems to me, if we can learn anything from the Bible, it has to do with the fact that what they are patriotic about, if you want to use that word, is not a piece of land, not an exclusive group of people, but God and their relation through God to others. Well, no, so patriotism goes beyond national boundaries, certainly, in the Bible. I suppose I should add to your what you commented about me, but I enlisted in the army in World War II and served about 3 years.
Ralph, when you use those terms, it made me wonder for the first time, is there religious patriotism And as you talked about the Holy Land and the temple in Jerusalem, isn't some of that patriotism maybe in an extreme religious fundamentalism what is operating on many sides now, at least in the Holy Land and maybe in Bosnia before that and other places? In other words, is patriotic religionism a problem?
I would say yes. In fact, I think it's a dangerous kind of patriotism. Certainly there are people in almost all faiths who are willing to die for their, what they consider their faith. And that's one of the great problems, that we fall back on a religion which is very good, but we put a switch on it that negates everything. Why I'm bothered, and I'll say this quite plainly, I am bothered by the idea that President Bush feels God has put him in that office. Yeah. Well, that's okay. I can accept that. To rule the world, if you say. He doesn't say that in those words, but it comes out that way to me. God has given me this most powerful job in the entire world in order to bring our values to them. And that anybody who feels he's a Messiah is a problem.
We had a pastor at our church that used to call that civil religion.
Yeah.
We talked about that.
Ben, you and I, this is just such a good take on, what were you saying about religion and what Hans Kung has been trying to do? Remember we were talking about that today?
Well, he was trying to do some things that to use all the world religions and coming together in more of an ecumenical fashion, particularly for areas of justice. Because almost all religions have different precepts of justice, whether it be for human rights, for women's issues, and whatever, and they can be combined, and it would be something that is common to all nationalities and all religions. And from that base, then they can, you know, do some things towards peace or whatever, or just plain justice.
And so he's trying to do this in terms of an interreligious dialogue, pluralistic kind of approach?
Yes.
Does he have like an international organization, or what is that?
I'm sorry, in the early 90s, there was a consortium or a seminar type deal where they were trying to get some of these ideas to solidify them into certain four key elements or something like that, so they could go back out and do that. But I'm sorry, I don't have all the elements that they were talking about.
Are there questions or reactions or statements that people, some of these things have evoked? Either that it's riled you up a little bit, that you'd like to contest, that it's been too one-sided. One of the things we do here at Holden a lot of times is, you know, we tend to evoke the same voice. That's why I think it's very healthy if we can evoke many voices.
I'm intrigued by the comment about a mercenary army that we have now. Having served 10 years active duty in both the draft army as an officer and in the Volar, what we call it, voluntary army, I've had a perspective on both. And I would say that the young men and women that volunteer to serve, devotion, serve this country, it's a great disservice to sort of categorize them as a mercenary army. The people, I've got a nephew that we talked to quite seriously about going to college, and we all did what we thought was the right thing, and he decided he wanted to go to the Marine Corps. And once he decided to do that, we all supported him in that. He's gone through training, and he'll be deployed to Iraq sometime around September. So we're naturally concerned about that, but I can tell you that Corey didn't join the Army because he was poor, because he had no options, because he had no support, no family, no mother, father. He joined because that's what he wanted to do. And most of the people are not represented by what happened in that prison that served the United States today. I can tell you that from my personal service, and the people I interacted with, and the people that I know are in the service now. They act out of service, just like people that volunteer to serve the Peace Corps serve this country, people that serve in AmeriCorps serve this country, people that volunteer to be a part of the government and do some pretty thankless jobs on all our behalf and take a lot of heat for it, volunteer to do that as well. Sometimes not so well, sometimes better, but that's just one thing I had to get off my chest because that concerns me because I've heard that in the press, that we have this mercenary army. We do not. We have dedicated men and women who have volunteered to serve in that fashion, and they trust, as I did as an officer, that the political leadership that we all elect, and all volunteer to support, that they make good decisions. Because once they make a decision, people in the military don't get to say, excuse me, we don't want to be deployed there.
I wanted to ask you about that. How much active duty did you have?
10 years.
And when you're on active duty, did you ever have a disagreement with what the executive branch had you doing? Did you ever feel this tension?
We were allowed to think. But we, unless it was an unethical or an unlawful act, you know, if we were ordered to go into battle or something, then that's what we do. Now, I came in 72, right at the end of the Vietnam era, so I didn't have the great pleasure of participating in that event. But I served in what we thought was the great time of the confrontation with Russia and was stationed in Germany on the east-west German border, where I saw the effects for myself of a country that chooses to imprison its own citizens. And we had the opportunity to take 18-year-old soldiers and see that as well, as they did border duty there, barbed wire guarded with all of that. So there was an opportunity just to experience that. But
I've read some things recently. I've been very involved in a lot of ways with Iraq for several years. I've read some things recently that in interviews with some of the soldiers who are on the ground there now, there's a lot of concern about what people's attitude are going to be about them when they come home.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, as there was in Vietnam. Good thing is, I think
it's terrible in Vietnam.
Little different now because people seem to separate support for the soldier and then the whatever controversy you want to discuss about what the political leadership decides to do or not to. I think that's all fair game, but I think it's unfair to blame soldiers as it was in Vietnam. The soldiers didn't get to say. Well, some voted to go to Canada and other places, but for the most part, you know, the people that went to Vietnam did what they did because they thought that was their duty. And when they came back and they were castigated for that, as if they really had a choice in that, particularly in a draft, they didn't have a choice. They were told to go, and they went.
What do you think a soldier should do if the order is questionable in his or her mind ethically?
You are allowed to question that, and you are not obligated to obey it if you truly believe it's unethical. For instance, Lieutenant Calley and Mili. Any of those soldiers could have said, we refuse to do this, and they would have been no problem and would have never been court-martialed for failing to kill innocent civilians. That's never, as an example, that's never justified.
And yet, in a more impersonal way, when they're lobbing rockets into Fallujah right now, you know, in retaliation for one thing or another, you know, just like the Israelis know, when they're lobbing rockets into Ramallah, innocent civilians are going to be killed. It's unavoidable.
Yes.
How do you resolve that dilemma?
It's a difficult thing to resolve, and it goes back to what the Army is designed to do. And the Army is not designed to do what it's doing right now. It's not. Army officers aren't typically trained to nation build. They're trained to fight wars, and the military force is designed to fight and win a war, and then turn it over to others to build that nation back. After World War II, we did that with civilians. We're trying to do that with military now, who are both providing security and trying to build infrastructure and recreate, in essence, the structure for a government. That's very difficult to do, and they're being asked to do something they typically are not expected to know how to do. And in most of the cases, from what I've read, they're figuring it out on the ground, that as Americans are good at doing, with very little insight into exactly how to get it done. But that's the problem with, it's, you know, they always say it's really easy to start a war, it's really difficult to stop one and clean up the aftermath. Because once you commit to it, there's no way, even with all the technology we have, you can be perfectly surgical and only kill bad people. Because a lot of times you're not even sure who they are, and it's without a doubt certain that innocent people will be killed.
Yeah. I saw your hand up back here.
I was looking at the definition of patriot, and devotion is something that I have always thought belonged in religious language. And then the next thought was, well, that's the new religion. Patriotism is the new religion in this country for some people. And that alarms me. I really do think we need a separation between church and state. And I think we can be very patriotic and support the troops, but I'm not devoted to my country like I am to my God. And my country is not my God.
I heard a wonderful sermon by someone. I thought it was very courageous, because it's hard to say things like this when you're a pastor. And the sermon was that what I pledge my allegiance to and what I am devoted to is the principles of equal protection of laws, freedom, due process of law, rule of law. I do not pledge my allegiance to, or nor am I devoted to, a nation or an administration or a policy, particularly when that policy deviates from the principles that I think. And so she said that's why she no longer could say the Pledge of Allegiance, because she pledges her allegiance to principles that come from her faith.
I have kind of a simple question, and it's probably not related to anything, but I was wondering, when we hear they're fighting for our freedom, I don't quite understand what that means. Maybe I'm just naive, I don't know.
Anyone want to take a shot at that? I mean, not to justify it or to just, you know, does that question resonate? Keith, tell us a little more what you're thinking about. I think I know, but put some more words to it.
Well, I don't really know. I guess that's why I was asking the question, because it seems like such a simple question, and yet I have trouble with the fighting in Iraq. Having something to do with my freedom. I just don't know how that equates.
The way I think about that is that there's the freedom. I think the rationale, the underlying assumption is that the fundamental freedom is freedom from fear, and with that is the notion that it's basically kill or be killed. That's the worldview that comes with fighting, using war as a tool to promote freedom, because your notion of the world is that this is a world where you have to kill or be killed. That's how I understand it. There's a book that was written by one of the people who are in the Bush administration at the policy level, Daniel Keegan, I can't remember the name of the book, where basically he said, we are in a position, this country's in a place right now, where we have such a differential in our military power of anybody else, unprecedented in history, that we have an obligation to use that military power to promote the principles, the values of our, you know, democracy, whatever we might want to define it. To me, that is the, you know, and it's a, you know, very strong expression of the way we promote ours is kill or be killed. Mm-hmm. That's basically the underlying assumption. I don't know that it's that much more complicated than that, if anybody has another way of viewing it.
Could you?
Well, I was going to say it seems
when I hear people refer to it that way, that they're fighting for our freedom, it's usually people who were older during World War II, and they come back with, well, do you want another Hitler type of situation, where they keep taking over more and more of the world. World War II, if we didn't have it, we maybe would have been under control of Hitler, or et cetera, is what they say. And so that's a context in which I've heard it used. And usually these same people will say something like, you have to support your country because you're an American, so therefore you have to support Bush, and you have to support what they do. You know, kind of comes from that type of thinking.
So from your intonation, I take it you don't agree with that kind of thinking?
No, I don't. Not at all.
This switches the conversation back to the language of the mercenary army. My understanding of that, the way that's framed, not the people who are actually our soldiers, but the people who are being paid by private companies, corporations, to go in and do certain things. To me, that's what my sense is of this mercenary part, that we're not talking about our soldiers who are enlisted in the army or in any of the services, but those people who are paid to, you know, do certain jobs within the context of this war. And that, I think that's the scary part, is that they, you know, I don't think they're in it, I mean, for other than their, what they can get paid or how they can promote what they're doing.
Well, I know that one fellow who was in custody, he was driving a truck for someone, and he escaped. I remember that they said he was going to bankruptcy, and he went over there because, you know, he knew he could make some money, you know, get special pay kind of thing, and that's certainly true. Jack?
Just with regard to the mercenary part, I'm in full agreement with the gentleman over here, that our men that are serving because they're choosing to serve. They're not there because they have to be there. They're there because they want to be there. And I'm in full concurrence with his thought that the Abu Ghraib thing was a very small minority of folks. And I apologize for the use of the word mercenary, but it was a contextual thing in that you all are hiring folks to be your soldiers for you, and those of you that are male and female and could serve and manifest your patriotism along the lines that we have chosen to, have abrogated your opportunity or abrogated your responsibility to do that.
Did anyone see that legislation that was proposed? I think it was pretty much a political statement that for a new draft, and it was by some liberals in Congress, and they said the new draft would include everyone.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
No matter what. And so all the senators' sons and daughters and, you know, just to really raise the issue. And it would also apply for if you were disabled, they'd find a route for you to participate. And if you were CEO, they could find something. But every person, kind of like I think Germany has a 1 year, you either go in the army or you do community service for a year.
One more piece on that, and that is with regard to the local patriotism. The man sitting over there, your name is?
Frank.
Frank, I'm John. We're on the streets, and I was an Army officer. I took an oath. I'm still on the streets, and I'm observant, and I'm watching. So in the event that I'm in a 7-Eleven store, something happens, I'm there. And that's a piece most people don't understand. I think you would concur in that. He's still ready to lay his life down, as am I.
Yes, sir.
I want to get back to that missed opportunity. I think I got a sense from the nonverbal language that a lot of people resonated with that. I felt a patriot for 2 weeks, and it was profound. And I was waiting. See, I want someone else to be courageous, not me. I was waiting for someone in leadership, particularly government, to say, you know, why do people around the world have such hate for Americans? I didn't hear anybody say that. Like, in other words, interdependence is, okay, let's scapegoat one group, but let's not look at ourselves, let's not look at our dark side. It, you know, because then fear becomes the overriding thing, survival. And that's my great sadness, is that we've missed the opportunity to understand how our foreign policies contribute significantly to how people respond to us. And after a while, it's a loop. You don't know how it started, but we both, you know, all the parties have responsibility for the way they contribute to the loop being maintained. And where, you know, where does the transcendence come? You know, because that's what I'm afraid. Because at that time, I couldn't have said anything from my pulpit. I had been out. It's like, that would have been so unpatriotic to say, why do people hate us? Mm-hmm. At a time that we're wounded and hurting, how can you say that? We didn't deserve this.
There was a pastor here last week who was talking about that same thing, that window of opportunity afterwards. And she said she was waiting for leadership to ask her to do something. Begin to be less reliant on oil, anything, you know, that all that energy could be mobilized. And she said the only thing she heard was go out and buy a new whatever.
Go shopping.
Go consume. Go shopping was the only message to the people, you know, for support and to do that.
But part of the problem is we were all waiting and somebody has to step out and do it. And if we're all just sitting and waiting for someone else to do it, then each one of us that waited is just as guilty because we sat and waited.
So. Eric, did you have your hand on it? I just, that really suggests to me that at the root of a lot of our struggle with violence, that it's our complacency and greed and not thinking of carelessness with how we consume.
That it's not my job to do it. Someone else should do it.
Well, and just and the idea that we don't think about how our individual actions contribute to a whole country, like that we as people really are responsible for what our country does. I mean, that's another sense of patriotism that really comes home to me, is that I'm a member, so and my individual actions, it's not like there's a body with a head. All of us as individuals acting that create our world. And
what can we do? Really, I mean, we're right at this point, we talk about the issues, and then like, what could you do in a situation like that? You know, where there's this wonderful opportunity. Some of them, maybe it isn't the brief action, but let's talk about alternatives. I mean, we all seem, this, there seems some consensus in the room here about, you know, that there would like to be, but what do you do when the paradigm we've thought from, as Rick mentioned back there, is always, you know, if we're killed, we're going to kill. And that's the way the world has worked for a couple thousand years. Is there a Christian alternative?
Yeah, I think so. I wanted to say, and I think this will connect, that there was some moment that people have alluded to where everybody was paying attention, but it doesn't mean that the opportunity has passed to examine why it is that Americans may be disliked by some people in the world. That needs to be part of our policy all the time. And one of the things we can do is make sure that conversation is taking place in the political arena and support candidates who are willing to ask that question, rather than candidates who say, all we need to do is establish our power and maintain it so that no matter how badly they hate us, we can hold them off, which seems to me pretty much our policy at the moment. And so I think it's one thing we can do is foster conversation about how we have a diplomacy or a stance in government that will work for mutual understanding.
And also remember, there's an opportunity here at Holden for us to register to vote if it's listed
today
on the kiosk today.
Yeah.
Is it passed? Is it opportunity? So I'm encouraging people to do that if you're not registered.
I think it's also important to uphold the gospel. If you want a Christian alternative, it would be good to look at Jesus Christ and what his role in the world was, which was to reconcile. To not overcome violence or fear or hatred with more violence, fear or hatred, but to extend love and acceptance and forgiveness and provide for the needs of all so that no one needs to live in fear or hatred. The gospel is pretty profound that way, and I think part of our responsibility as Christians is to expect and encourage this conversation, not just in our politics, but in our congregations. It's very sad for me that it's a blessing to live here at Holden and be able to preach on these topics regularly, and essentially be preaching to the choir, though. But then to still hear back. That you know, I wanted to hear the gospel, and I don't want to hear about politics. Well, if the gospel isn't informing our politics, and if we can't talk about politics as a direct correlation to where the gospel leads us, then the gospel, what's the point? Politics is how we interact with people. That's what politics is, how people interact, and that's the gospel message, is love one another.
A radical call to discipleship.
Yeah.
Lou.
I think one of the best alternatives you can give people is to educate people so they can make informed decisions in their own lives when it comes to joining the military. And a part of that education is looking at some of the history of our political leaders, what they've been involved in, and that's going from Johnson to Bush Senior, knowing what I know from looking underneath the pages at what some of these men have been involved in, I definitely would go to jail before I serve them. And so it's really, really important that these people who are in positions of power, their backgrounds are exposed and what they've been involved in, so that people can make decisions about their own lives, whether they are going to serve in the military, whether they believe in what they're doing. But if that education isn't out there and that information isn't out there, people are going to go blind in situations that they're going to regret later on. That's all I have to say.
Yes, sir. Just read a very long editorial page article in the Tacoma newspaper by a retired political figure and college president, saying that for $20 billion a year worldwide, we could prevent billions of children from dying of hunger. And that without, I mean, clearly that's gospel. But without mentioning gospel, all kinds of political reasons why that would do more to solve terrorism than 10 times that amount of military expenditure, and that there is a plan that is workable. Now, I cannot judge whether that's correct or not, but he had some very strong names listed as supporting that plan.
This is a good opportunity. Here's one very specific thing. When you say no to war, what do you say yes to? And that's really a dilemma. You know, I used to get things in the mail here from people who say, people always talk about peace and they don't have, you know, how do you make peace? So these are some great ideas. One specific is I'm volunteering for a nonviolent peace force. They're trying to put together a peace army worldwide so that when there is an emerging conflict, they use third-party intervention, nonviolent techniques. We have 16 people on the ground in Sri Lanka right now in the first pilot project to come in and be part of the solution, create the space to stop the violence long enough so that the people there can come up with the answers. And it's been researched. They're trying to build it around the world. There are organizations from all over the world that are supporting it, and so it's one kind of idea. So I brought a bunch of pamphlets here if anyone's interested, could take a look at that sort of thing.
And I think the beauty of our country and other countries too is that administrations come and go, but we have wonderful organizations that are in the world, Mercy Corps and Lutheran War Relief and all kinds of organizations that are continually working to to help with hunger, and we could support those, and they're the hope. that's where I have my hope, and that's the way we spread the gospel too.
And with education too, because there are groups that are educating at the Central Asian Institute, which educates girls in Pakistan and Afghanistan, trying to change people's opinions about us, and just small ways of reaching out.
Rob?
It occurs to me to suggest that if we define patriotism in a somewhat different way, all of us are patriots. Mm-hmm. You're talking about your concern about, I'm a part of this country that's doing bad. Okay? That's us doing bad. Whether we like it or not, we are a part of this country. It is our country, for good or bad, not that we approve the bad. But I am reminded of Daniel's prayer of repentance. He says to God, God, forgive me. He was not a part of the problem. He was an innocent bystander that got swept in. His country had done something wrong. Daniel said, forgive me for that. Can we take it upon ourselves? I am a part of this nation which is doing things I don't think it ought to. I don't know what part I've hit in it, if any, but God, forgive me. Yep.
One of the things I noticed happening is that people in other countries are stating that they're not angry with us, but they're angry with our government and our administration. And I'm saying, wait a minute. They're talking about me, they don't even know. Because I'm the government here. We're all this government. And whoever we have representing us is us. And those people that say that they're not angry with us, they don't know about democracy and how you have to get off your butt and stop being so lazy and get out there and find out who's running. And when you walk into the polls, you should know a whole lot about those folks. And if you don't, you better go find out. And there are lots of clubs and organizations. You can find out who is out there and who's running. At the end of July in Pierce County, all the people that are running for office will have put their names down and paid whatever little buck or whatever it is it'll cost them to run. And I know every judge that was running in Pierce County a couple years ago, I met every single one of them. And there's no reason why everyone can't do that. But boy, I'll tell you, there's some judges you don't want to have up there if you're standing in front of them. And it's just, it's really, really interesting process. We have a wonderful process, but I think that the real problem is that we are too lazy to find out who's running, and if they're like me, they're too lazy to run. That's something we can do. We can all run. But man, it's scary.
You know, when people from other countries say, I really like Americans, but I don't like American government, I think in part that's a reflection about if they're talking to another American, they're eye to eye, they're making that human contact, and you can realize we are all brothers and sisters.
Yeah, that's
right?
True.
Right. Rather than, you know, some ephemeral, you know, force or evil force.
Sorry, I already spoke once, but I just thought taking that, it's so easy when we are together to be human. Why do we, I just want to ask why we have that problem. And even, I think you said we, and I really like what Emily said, we have the answer too. Love each other. We know that. We know. Why don't we put it into practice? Yeah. What's wrong? What's missing?
One hard thing here, we were talking about this morning, is taking this spirit and these ideas when you get on the bus and go down. And you're worried about catching the boat, and then you finally get in your car, and you're worried about getting home, and you got to go to work the next day. You know, to embody some of this in your life, rather than just go become an ugly patriot again, instead of a beautiful patriot, like, you know, we've just been fashioning here. I mean, how can we support each other in making that transition? Because that's the mission of Holden is the renewal of Christ in the world. When you go down and take it out here, so it's not just up here in this, you know, artificial, idyllic setting.
Well, that was my thought. What hits home for me as being the mother of two boys that could be drafted if the draft would be reinstated, a colleague of the women that sons are over there fighting for us, for me, I can support them in my little neighborhood, I can support the families that I see at the park, my friend Cheryl praying for her son, you know, always in the back of her mind, scared whether he'll come home dead or alive, that in my own little world, I can pray for them, encourage them with notes or whatever. And for me, that seems more tangible than, I mean, I agree to be informed and educate and do all that as well, but the picture is so huge that I can bring it down to my level in my neighborhood, supporting each other, and then encouraging others to reach out.
Thanks.
I really think it's important what she just said, because I think the theory of action that I have is bite-sized chunks.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to do, what's our theme? Summoned out to be what we can be. This is what she's summoned to do. Each of us has whatever, you know, the woman over here is summoned to be involved in races, you know, political races around judges. You got to start from the place of where you are called, what your passion is. And then you go out from there. And on that basis, a little advertisement, on Thursday evening at 6:20, there will be a video in here about the Karuna Center for Peace Building, which will show another example, like the Nonviolent Peace Force, of ways that Americans are saying yes to peace versus having to only be saying no to war. So be here, be square.
Well, in about 30 seconds, the bell's going to ring for a hamburger. And I'll have to be in Stampede, so I want to make sure to take time. And french fries? I don't think we can do french fries. Probably potatoes.
French fries.
Oh, no,